Welcome back to Ashburton. We're about ready to start now.
It's political commentary.
Very good morning to you, Rod Oram.
Good morning, Mikey.
How are you this morning?
I'm very well, thank you. And you too, I hope.
I'm very well. I'm a little bit shaken overnight hearing that speculation that there may be some sort of New Zealand being part of an envoy to North Korea with Winston. Why does Winston Peters want to go to North Korea?
I don't have an immediate answer to that. One of the things that fascinates me about him is that he seems to be able to make a very good build very good relationships with senior people, such as he did with the U.S. previous Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice. And he had a number of meetings with the current Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, over the last week. And I find it very interesting that he's able to build those relationships. And therefore, maybe he can play a role. Obviously, he presumably doesn't behave towards other diplomats the way he sort of behaves here in public in his belligerence. As long as people see the thoughtful, focused Winston rather than the erratic and combative one, I'm sure he might be useful.
Do we know any more about whether it is a US-led sort of peace initiative thing, or a smoothing over, or
no idea. This is
because that would be unusual if Labor just jumped straight into that cold, wouldn't it?
Yeah, although it'd never be entirely cold, because our diplomats and our Ministry of Foreign Affairs is, you know, on top of the issue, is up with the play. And Winston Peters, as a former foreign minister, and who's obviously kept up his interests in opposition, would be able to jump in. But I just have no idea, and I don't think anybody does. This is all very mysterious and very intriguing. Not nearly as interesting as the All Whites, but almost.
The Peruvians lit on fireworks at 3 o'clock in the morning. That's exciting if you're a football fan. So the last week's been an interesting one. We had Jacinda's been at APEC and has achieved a wee bit there. Definitely riled Malcolm Turnbull.
And again, it's very interesting to see how our Prime Minister's working that. She couched it very much in terms of the previous government here had made that offer, and she is continuing that. And she's also couching it very much in terms of Australia says this is a regional issue, and therefore we as a partner in the region are trying to help them. And so we're not trying to embarrass them, we're just trying to say, hands up for 150.
It does embarrass them though, doesn't it?
Well, inevitably it does, but rightly so. But I think she's playing those cards very well. And I thought it was a little bit churlish of Bill English yesterday to say, oh, this is, you know, is this only show? He knows very well that these negotiations and the like are very difficult to do. You never know quite where you're going with them. But it's very clear the intention is very real. And it was an intention that was set up by the offer from the previous government, of which Bill English, I guess at that point, was only Deputy Prime Minister. But anyway, I think it's well worth seeing where this goes. And it's a horrendous human rights abuse all round by the Australians, and they need to find a way out of it, and they'll need all the help they can get.
Bill English has been quite churlish, hasn't he, this last sort of week, the way that his... They might be a formidable opposition, but they haven't been opposition for a while, obviously.
No, and it's going to take them quite a while to sort of tune into that. There certainly have been some combative speeches by one or two of them, but that's not the same as being a constructive opposition. I had a real problem with a comment that English made very early on. You know, it's not our job to make this place run smoothly. Well, actually it is, but in a constructive way. You need constructive opposition. If you want to see what an obstructive opposition looks like, you only need to look at the Republicans, well, the Democrats are pretty good at it too, in Congress, where there's been a complete breakdown because it's impossible for the two parties to reach a bipartisan agreement on anything. So an opposition has a real responsibility to be a constructive opposition, so that it's not, you know, it's still standing up for what it believes, but it's trying to get some things done. And so I took that comment from English is that they're all trying to adjust to the new reality. And of course, over the summer, it all gets very quiet anyway. And when they come back after the summer holidays and realize it's still very quiet because they hardly ever get any media coverage, I think that's when it'll sink in a bit more.
You've gotten a column out this week challenging the new government's plan to change the urban-rural boundary around Auckland. I talked a little bit to Phil Goff about this yesterday, but what are your thoughts?
It's in a sense, quite straightforward. We worked incredibly hard in Auckland to arrive at the unitary plan, with the rural-urban boundary substantially different from the previous metropolitan urban limit. So it's further out and it's more flexible. But within it, it helps concentrate where infrastructure investment needs to go. So it's not just roads and railway stations or whatever, it's schools and hospitals and, you know, goes on and on.
Like you say, it is very well thought out, that plan. There's been a lot of effort.
And the plan gives the scope for something like 420,000 new homes in Auckland over the next 25 or 30 years. And there would be, it's a relatively easy process to get private plan changes to move outside the rural urban boundary. But what Phil Twyford wants to do, and I've never understood his logic, is that he thinks that that should just be biffed. And so people could seek permission to build homes, not everywhere. There would still be some restrictions and you'd be turned down in some places. But the idea is that there's lots of really cheap rural land out there, and therefore that would allow for more affordable housing.
So just a big spread.
Absolutely. But a number of big problems arise. The first one is that you're then starting to spread infrastructure all over the place when, you know, we can't afford to build the infrastructure we need, you know, within the existing network and the extensions of it.
Is that that's the reason we can't afford to, or we don't have time to?
Actually, both.
Yeah.
But, of course, one of the key things about infrastructure is you need to build with some density of population and some scale to do that most efficiently. So if you start saying, well, all of a sudden there's 10,000 houses in this, you know, far corner of the rural south of Auckland, oh, we've got to connect that to everything, beef up all the connections, that gets more expensive. But here's the other thing, is that if we consign our people on the lowest incomes to the furthest away, which is what this would do, then they have the horrendous commute and all the costs of that. And that's not the right answer. The right answer is to work out how to build more affordable housing closer in. Auckland is a very undense city. We are less dense in terms of urban population than Los Angeles. That's how spread out we are.
Wow.
And I'm taking out all the rural bits. I'm talking about only where we've built. The population density is lower than Los Angeles. And so the unitary plan is a very good plan for trying to concentrate that growth and bringing some big parcels of land together and trying to get real innovation in how we build. That's the issue, not more land. There's plenty of land already available to build on. We don't have enough people to build on it, and we don't know how to build fast and efficiently and at scale to build affordable homes.
The thing is, Phil Twyford's in a position, though, where he needs to pretty much be checking out a press release a week, doesn't he?
A lot of
pressure on that part of the government's policy.
Yes, but there's lots of other things he can get going. But the thing is, I had some brief conversations with him about this, particularly during the campaign, and I just don't see his logic at all. And that to me is a real worry.
Yeah, I heard that there's a massive drop in overseas property buyers of residential properties the minute that the new government came in, and that now they've all started to buy commercial properties because that doesn't come under the regulation. So that just could lead itself to other problems. Hey, you're speaking at this week's Federation of Māori Authorities conference in Rotorua, as is Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern. What's all that about?
Oh, well, look, it's a huge privilege because it's their 30th anniversary. So this is one of the peak bodies of Māori in terms of bringing many of their major organisations together. And so a very thoughtful, powerful organisation. So I've been asked to talk about long-term sustainability. How do we, 20, 30 years out, make sure that New Zealand is a deeply sustainable country? Of course, that's environmentally, but it's culturally, it's economically, it's socially. And, of course, Māori are very focused on this. They have a very long-term view. And it's one that I... This is absolutely core to all the work I do. I'm very much in the here and now of today's news, whether it be politics or business. But I'm always, always thinking about these issues. And so I have a chance to talk about that on Saturday morning, which I very much appreciate the offer.
Cool. Will you bring up the TPP, or whatever it's called now?
I hadn't. Probably not.
Do we even know anything? Do we really have an idea what it is now, or is it just a shonky version of before, or is it the TPP light?
Some progress has been made. However, what is being entirely missed here is what's going on with Canada and Mexico, because they got together to push the negotiations in a useful way, but then they've taken time out because of their automotive sector.
Taking time out didn't turn up.
No, well, yes, that wasn't quite such a good idea, but anyway.
They could have been a bit clearer about that, couldn't they?
Yeah, but no. But here's the really big issue. Their overriding problem at the moment is Donald Trump wants to biff the North American Free Trade Agreement, which they are the other two partners in, which has deeply integrated the three economies, Canada, US, Mexico, particularly in the automotive industry. And they're just about to go into round six of their negotiations. They've made very little progress so far. It's supposed to only be seven rounds, and that could obviously be extended. But Trump keeps on saying he's had enough and he wants to just pull the plug on NAFTA, which he could do astonishingly easily. He only has to give 6 months' notice, and the US can walk away from it. It would be an economic disaster for all three countries. But that's not anything that would get him, wouldn't trouble him too much. But here's the really big issue.
That'd be quite Trump 2017, wouldn't it?
Yeah. But here's the really big issue. Mexico and Canada are intensely focused on that. They can't sign off on a multilateral agreement in Asia that the US has walked away from when they're trying to negotiate a bilateral relationship in the US with Trump, who believes, you know, the Asian stuff and TPP was a complete nonsense. Moreover, they can't complete TPP or CPTPP, as we now call it. And including the automotive sector until they sort out NAFTA. So,
Rod, that is the clearest picture I've had painted of that whole situation by anybody in the world that I've heard in the last 2 weeks. Thank you very, very much for that.
Well, no, it's incredibly straightforward, and the problem is...
This is the thing. Yes, thank you for making it incredibly straightforward.
Well, but here's the point. This is all completely obvious if you read the Canadian press.
Canadian press? There's no such thing, is there?
The Toronto Globe and Mail is a fine newspaper. I started my journalism career at the Report on Business section of it 42 years ago.
do you reckon that's a good go-to place for news? The Toronto, was it?
Globe and Mail.
All right. I'm going to chuck that on my go-to list from now on.
And very excellent newspaper. And but the really important thing is what the Canadians were talking about, what happened in the negotiations, this was a Canada first moment. So Canada had to put itself first in terms of what it's dealing with in the US.
Sure.
And it hasn't parked CPTPP, but we were also focused on whether or not we could sell houses to foreigners and, you know, the dispute settlement stuff and all the rest. We were looking at only from our point of view and not trying to understand what on earth was going on with the Canadians and the Mexicans. And I think that's the huge issue that's hanging over all of this.
Rod, thank you very much for talking to us again this morning. Always a pleasure. I hope you have a wonderful week.
Thanks, you too. And thanks for ranging far and wide across many of my favourite subjects.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Okay, see you.
See you, Rod.
Bye.
You just heard a bit of political commentary.